Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. A police officer named Eric Casebolt in McKinney, Texas, has just resigned after being at the center of a major controversy caught on videotape. Casebolt was seen roughing up a number of African-American teenagers at a pool party in broad daylight, in particular forcing a 15-year-old girl wearing a bikini onto the ground by her hair and digging his knees into her back as she lay prone, face down, crying for her mother. He also pulled out his gun, despite the fact that no one at the scene was armed and most were in bathing suits. Police Chief Greg Conley called Casebolt's actions, quote, indefensible, and has launched an investigation. The scene unfolded when an apparently unauthorized party of African-American teens was organized at an admission-restricted pool for a master-planned community called Craig Ranch. Also part of the story is a fight that apparently took place between the black host of the party and a white resident. The white resident reportedly yelled at the black woman to go back to her, quote, Section 8 housing. The video of Casebolt interacting with the kids was taken and uploaded online by a 15-year-old white boy named Brandon Brooks, who says the police completely ignored white residents and others like himself and simply targeted the people of color. On Monday, more than 1,000 mostly black protesters marched to the pool at the center of the scandal and denounced the police violence and racism. My guest is Michelle Goodwin, professor of law and chancellor's chair at the University of California, Irvine, founding director of the Center for Biotechnology and Global Health Policy. Welcome to Uprising, Michelle.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. Well, so the video of the police officer arresting he handcuffed the young girl. In the end, only one boy was arrested. I'm wondering if you've seen the video and what your general impressions are of what happened and what was captured on it.
I have seen the video. The video is chilling. It's shocking. It's shocking that such things occur in 2015, but it's part of what we've been seeing week after week, captured by video and assault, brutality forced on unarmed people of color, African-American, in this case, a 14-year-old girl in a bikini who clearly has no weapon on her. And in fact, she's not one of the kids that's confused and fleeing. She may be confused, but she's not running. She's not trying to avoid the police. She just sits and he yanks her up and he yanks her hair and he slams her face down and then puts his girth on her as he slams her to the ground, putting his knees on her. It's absolute violence and it's completely uncalled for. And, you know, what many people haven't noticed in the video is that there are white adults who are just roaming around. There's a white man who stands above while all of this stuff happens. And at no point does he seek to intervene. And it raises a very interesting question for all of us about where is our humanity? At what point, when we see something that's so horrific, do we intervene? And it seems that the only thing that this other resident is missing is perhaps his popcorn or some chips, because he does not intervene. He doesn't, you know, seem in shock at all. It seems that this is just a completely normal thing to do. And we have to move away from the normalcy, or thinking that, you know, or the cognitive biases that would allow us to say that this is okay to do to a small 14-year-old black girl, when I seriously doubt that there would be the same police response to a white resident, right, or to a white swimmer who's 14 and in a bikini. I think that there would be the kind of outrage that's not just, you know, 1,000 people of color marching, but I think that that would get whites out marching too and saying, that is so abusive. How dare anybody do that?
And actually, going back to what you were saying about the white residents, I think you're referring to, there's a tall, heavyset man wearing like a beige polo shirt and denim blue shorts. And he, what struck me was not that he didn't intervene, but that he almost seemed like he was part of the police force, as if he was an ununiformed deputy, because he was hovering around and even holding back at one point the girl's friends who were trying to help her. He was allowing the police access to her. And, there was this unspoken sense that he and the cop were part of the club that the kids are not included in. And for those of our viewers and listeners who haven't seen the video, do watch it. It's available widely online. It's difficult, of course, to watch a little child being brutalized in that way. But I think it's important to see this unspoken connection between the cop and the white resident, because that lays bare the fact that time and again, we have white Americans calling police to deal with altercations that do not require police intervention when there are African Americans involved and the police simply doing the bidding, right?
Well, you know, it's part of something that's really important for us to talk about, and that's how these cognitive biases and these historical, historically rooted stereotypes and stigmas continue. You know, I want to share with you a case from 1971. It's Palmer v. Thompson. It's a very interesting case because it helps to put into context our narrative around swimming pools in the United States. It's a 1971 case, so 17 years after Brown v. Board of Education, and by this time, we've desegregated in housing, in education, the Voting Rights Act has been passed, and so forth. So some real civil rights victories. But notice in 1971, the U.S. Supreme Court says that it's permissible for Jackson, Mississippi to close down its swimming pools rather than to integrate them. Jackson, Mississippi argues that, well, if we're forced to integrate these swimming pools, it's going to cost us a lot of money. And on this, they believe they're right. And here's why. Because during that period in our country, both when blacks tried to swim in many cities and municipalities and Latinos, the municipalities would then close the pool, drain the pool, bleach the pool, and then fill it back up for its white residents. So it's a way in which the public health was used as a proxy for racism. The Supreme Court agrees. The Supreme Court says that, look, this is an equal protection challenge where blacks have said that they would be unequally oppressed by this. And the Supreme Court says, well, if they're shutting down the pools, then everybody is affected in the same way. And of course, that's not the rationale that's used in Brown v. Board of Education when Southern school districts tried that too and said, well, we'll just shut down all the schools. And the Supreme Court said that that's not permissible. But in 1971, as it related to swimming pools, the U.S. Supreme Court said that was fine because it's important to remember that race mixing in that very intimate way really seemed like a health harm. It goes back to the stereotype that blacks are somehow polluted and infected. And one last point on Palmer v. Thompson, this case, the city shuts down all of its pools, but it leases one of the pools to the YMCA, knowing that the YMCA prohibits blacks from swimming. So it's a shocking case for how recent it is, and it's a shocking case given the plethora of other cases where the Supreme Court said that that kind of racism, bigotry, and bias is just simply not permissible.
Michelle, what you're describing just reminds me so much of India's caste system, right? The Dalit caste, which is considered in the Hindu caste system the lowest of castes, they used to be called untouchables, literally because they were considered polluted. Often they were darker skinned. And, you know, what you were describing just reminded me instantly of that sense that the upper caste Hindus felt that they would literally be physically polluted if they touched accidentally even somebody from these quote untouchable caste. So this is the sort of backdrop for the story of what's happened and happening in McKinney. There's another aspect that I'd like to bring up to you. The young girl, the 14, some newspapers are saying 15-year-old girl, and I want to say her name because there's this campaign that I think is a really important campaign in the Black Lives Matter movement to say her name, say the names of African-American women who have been killed by law enforcement, in this case roughed up. Her name is Dahiria Becton. I hope I'm pronouncing it right. D-A-J-E-R-R-I-A, Dahiria Becton. She is speaking out. But what happened to her, if you watch the video, veers dangerously close to sexual assault. She is wearing only a bikini. She was not armed. She was very vulnerable. She was young. And this man, this cop who's supposed to protect people, physically forced himself on top of her. Is that far-fetched to say that what he did veers dangerously close to sexual assault?
So, you know, in the American vernacular, where there's still such tension in terms of recognizing racism, I think that there would be people who say, well, of course not. That has nothing to do with sexuality or anything like that. But again, if we begin to unpack the historical narrative with this and the sexual abuse that African American women and girls have experienced in this country since times of antebellum slavery, much of which has taken centuries to acknowledge, right? I mean, we can think about examples with presidents, Thomas Jefferson, how many centuries literally did it take for there to be an acknowledgement that, yes, he fathered children by the slave that he raped, who happened to have been his wife's half-sister, right? I mean, and because we have such difficulty in recognizing that, and because there is a narrative about Blackness as not beautiful, there is also this cognitive bias that, well, of course, because African-American women aren't attractive, that of course there could never be the sexual assault. Who would ever want them? And yet what we know is that that too has been a very powerful legacy in the United States, yet unrecognized, yet unfully packed. And so in this particular case, yes, it reeks of her vulnerability because she's just wearing a bikini, which is totally permissible to wear, being at the beach or being in a swimming pool. And there is the extreme manipulation of her body and exploitation and assault on her body by this officer. I mean, he tugs at her hair with such violent force that it raises her neck back, and then he slams it forward and he puts the weight of his body on her while she's in this very vulnerable position in terms of what she's wearing, which again is appropriate for the activity that she was involved with. And yes, the peeping Tom image also of the resident who looks on all of this as it happens, it's very disturbing. Yeah. It really is. And importantly, Sonali, this should be disturbing for anybody to see. It shouldn't just simply be disturbing for African Americans and people of color. This should be the type of video where a parent watches it, a parent who has a white daughter, and says, I would never want my daughter to be treated that way.
Yeah.
That is totally impermissible.
You're asking for people to humanize people.
Absolutely.
Because that's
right?
Essentially
exactly.
It.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, this is our daughter. These are our daughters. And the very point that you make, the recognition of the African woman, American woman and girl and their bodies as being also the targets and the subjects of police violence and brutality. And you know, Sonali, it's something that's so often missed. I mean, when we talk about mass incarceration in this country, it's through a male lens. No one bothers to pay attention to the fact that the U.S. incarcerates more women than any other country in the world, more than China, India, Brazil, and Russia combined.
Wow.
So we're not paying attention to what happens in terms of women, their bodies, and the violence that they experience within their own communities, let alone by law enforcement. And we really urgently need for people to wake up and to see this because, you know, I always say that, you know, the poorest amongst us and those who are the most vulnerable are only the canaries in the coal mine. When this can happen in this community to these kids, and if you look at these kids closely, you will see how well trimmed the haircuts are for the boys, how well clad, even if in bikinis, the girls are. These are not kids who sort of ruffians coming from the roughest parts of town and found themselves there. If this can happen to the kids who come from middle class families and they're African American, soon this could happen to white people's children too. And that we must pay attention to.
Now, I have some friends who live in Texas who are normally very progressive minded, who have never denied that there exists serious racism and police violence that's out of control, who sent me long rants from white residents in McKinney who said there's another point of view about what happened, that the media are totally distorting it. The Dallas Morning News also published these so-called competing narratives where white residents are attempting to defend police action, saying that essentially the partygoers were this out-of-control mob who had no respect for authority, that the party had more attendees than was allowed at the pool. It was unauthorized. This was a private, you know, pool that they didn't have access to, that there were kids jumping over the fence. There was, you know, kids were smoking weed and drinking, although the black partygoers maintained that none of that was happening. So how do you, I mean, obviously neither you or I were actually physically there. So, but just from the video and just from what you've seen, for example, and the fact that 500 plus, almost at more than 1,000 people showed up to protest on Monday, clearly they are local residents. They felt that something unjust happened. So how do you respond to this? Well, there's two sides to the whole story.
Well, you know, this is an important, it's an important question, and it's something really important for us to respond to. It's important that that community responds to, and in a way, it's really good that they're honest, right? They're speaking honestly, and if they didn't, then it makes it very difficult to address these issues. Well, first, in the New York Times, there were two women who seemed to be residents of that community who said that they invited the party, that they lived there, and this was a party that they invited. Then there's another narrative that said, you know, sort of went viral, this invitation. And so many more people arrived than what they, than what may have been anticipated. Look, I completely understand that, you know, gated and other communities, they have their rules. It is important to follow those rules. And there are appropriate mechanisms for addressing residents who paint their homes the wrong color. There are gated communities that say you must only paint your home, you know, beige. And when the person paints his house blue, then there is a community, there's a community response that is already dictated in some bylaw rule for being in the community. That does not lead necessarily to police violence and people being yanked and banged on the ground, or folks having to lay face down on the sidewalks and things like that. And I completely understand if there are parties that get out of control. Look, white residents have parties that get out of control. Many people can. The question is, how do we respond to these incidents? How do we even see these incidents when they happen to affect marginalized communities? And I think that there's a very different way in which we view that. I mean, think about George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin, right? Like just that one night. For George Zimmerman, it seems completely out of his context that there would be a black kid walking down the street with a hoodie. There must be something wrong. And it's quite possible that had it not been a black kid walking down the street with a hoodie, but a white kid walking down the street with a hoodie, it would have been perceived as very different. There are many people who came to George Zimmerman's aid saying he had the right lens on that night. George's lens, that a black kid with a hoodie had to be up to something wrong, even though this kid was only carrying Skittles and iced tea, not beer, not whiskey, and iced tea. And it gives you two different frames in which people can look at things in our country, right? Same boy, but two different lenses where, you know, folks of color said, you know, this is just an innocent kid trying to get to where he's going to. And so to think about the residents and how they responded, first, I want to acknowledge there are rules and residents should follow their local community rules. But I also want to be mindful, too, that it's possible that people really see things very differently, so that what might have been seen by some other residents as, hey, these are just a whole lot of kids, they're a little bit loud, can you keep your guests down? For these residents might have seemed like something that was completely out of control, right, something that had gone very native, something that they couldn't rein back without the police. And therein lies the real tragedy, a lack of communication, an unwillingness to communicate. And as you say, the African-American women involved have said that one white resident said that they should go back to where they came from, when my understanding is that they actually came from that community.
Right. Section 8 housing. I want to thank you, as always, Michelle, for joining us, and we will definitely have you back on the program again.
Thank you so much for addressing these really important issues, Sonali. Thank you.
Michelle Goodwin is a professor of law and chancellor's chair at the University of California, Irvine. She's also the founding director of the Center for Biotechnology and Global Health Policy.